All right, a good evening to all. Here we are at the Or Zarua Talmud class. And we're meeting this Wednesday night, the second time in this semester, if you will, for learning Psachim, the last chapter of Psachim, Harvei Psachim. 10th chapter of Psachim in the Talmud Bavli. And we began with the Mishnah of the last time, which brought us into the issues of getting yourself ready for Pesach and making sure you were hungry enough to eat your matzah, and touching on whether or not you're hungry enough to eat your Shabbos meal with teavon, with an appetite, and also dealing with the regular poor in your community and making sure that they had not matzah, but arba kosot, four cups of wine, and had to make sure that the money that was used traditionally for their foodstuffs could even be used for the wine that they needed on Pesach evening because of the importance of the four cups. So we had a little bit of a discussion about why is it only teaching on Erev Pesach, because it should be that way on the Sabbath, and we went a little bit back and forth about whether or not we're dealing with the same kind of issues, whether or not prep for Shabbat and appetite for Shabbat is the same as having an appetite for Pesach. And I think that what we didn't get to, which I'll just start with and mention quickly, is that, you know, there's a philosophical underpinning of that question, right? What's kind of the anchor experience for the Jewish people, and which do you need the most appetite for, let's say, using appetite metaphorically, right? Do you need all year to really, really renew your relationship to the narrative of Yitziat Mitzrayim so that you can truly experience it at Pesach, as it says, Chayav Adam Lirod Et Atzmo Ke'ilu Hu Yatzam Mitzrayim. A person, him or herself, is obligated to see him or herself as if he or she really did go out of Egypt, and you're asked to invoke, as I've explained it before, the religious imagination deeply enough so that you not only consider yourself kind of metaphorically there, but you imagine yourself going out of Egypt. And if the appetite for Pesach and for reliving redemption is the one that's really chief and important, I can then, in a certain way, halachically, through the details of Jewish law, kind of put it out there that, okay, maybe I don't need to be as careful for Shabbos in the same way that I'm careful for this day of Erev Pesach. That there is some kind of philosophical underpinning to that. It kind of sits as a question for me as to whether or not the rabbis themselves related to the areas of Jewish law in this regard within the Talmudic framework themselves. I have to imagine, yes, that I'm not just imagining seeing that, but I definitely, in terms of machshava, in terms of the way we approach the text, to glean from it some idea of what this narrative of Jewish law is saying to us vis-a-vis our approach to any given year and the cycle of a holiday year, that it's really begging the question, are you creating enough of an appetite not only for Pesach but for both? Regardless of which one I think is, in a way, the one that I have to have more of an appetite for, I better get my appetite up for both of them, is the main point of the beginning of chapter 10 here. And that I need a certain tava, I need a certain appetite for both Pesach and all that it means, and Shabbat and all that it means in the normal, regular course of events in a Jewish life. And so that's why I believe it starts here, and that's why I believe it will begin to take as par for the course, even though I'm in Masechet Psachim, Passover, discussions about both the Pesach Seder and what I want to name the Seder Shabbat, the way we approach the Sabbath through the rituals of the meal and the rituals associated with the day.
You mentioned the quote-unquote appetite for Shabbat or for the Pesach. But the mitzvah for Shabbat is that if you don't do it, you will be karet. And there is no punishment for not observing Pesach. So they shouldn't be on the same level of quote-unquote appetite.
That's nice. So if you want to regard things as being most severe vis-a-vis their punishments, And you even say,
God put the punishment.
Yeah, I understand. But you're ranking them in that way in terms of their importance, in terms of
the
what you see. And that's very nice. It's very nice. I like that thought a lot. You know, the fact is there's no second chance once the Shabbos is gone, and there's a second chance once Pesach goes.
No, you have another.
You have a Pesach Sheni. You know, it's built into the fabric that you should even, like, if you missed it, God will grant you a certain amount of leeway, right? You'll be judged favorably if you didn't actually achieve your Pesach offering, and therefore you're given another chance. And so maybe the way to think is not so much about the severity of the punishment in Karet as with the Sabbath, like you're bringing up, but maybe it is that on the one hand, for Shabbos, I have Karet, I have to just really say that, you know, it's routine and I have to have a consequence that, quote-unquote, kind of fits the crime. But for Pesach, I have to be so forgiving. I have to be so open. I have to be so centrally focused on making sure everybody gets the chance to have this that I'm not going to cut somebody off. I'm actually going to create a second chance. And so that's an interesting kind of framework to think about if I wanted to push the matter of thinking through what the nature is of halachic practice and punishment and or result with each of these. But good thought.
Something came to me, not directly related to the Pesach and the Shabbat, but related to the Shabbat and the punishment. Just recalled, there's a phrase in the Talmud, Mishnah Olad b'Shabbat, Yamut b'Shabbat, Ki chilelu elav et ha-Shabbat. Which means that when a baby is born, Shabbat or no Shabbat, you have to take care of birth. Which means you're doing some work. And work is being done. So Shabbat, chilelu et ha-Shabbat. And the phrase says just that. These are the words, direct quote. Mishenolad b'Shabbat, yamut b'Shabbat. In other words, the death is like the punishment, the karet, but it will happen on Shabbat because chilelu elav et ha-Shabbat.
But they said that if somebody die on Shabbat, he's a tzaddik, so...
The quote. I'm quoting from the...
No, I'm giving you...
So is Ron.
Okay, so, then we have to...
Yeah, so we're not strangers to all... Yeah, well, we're not strangers to alternative interpretations.
There's something there, but anyway.
Yeah, there is something there. I mean, obviously, their intent to make so serious the notion that one would transgress on a Sabbath, and one would worry about one's soul and one's physical existence vis-a-vis one's Shabbat observance is really serious. Rabbis were really serious about that. But with the notion of a birth. On top of that, the notion of a bris, where the moel can carry, even if there's no eruv, there's no legal way to create that space in which one can transgress the prohibition against carrying. Yet, a moel can take his kelim, his tools specific to the trade, and make the mitzvah of the brit milah on the eighth day, on Shabbat. So you really have some instances where we say things to their extreme, thou shalt never carry. But we also know that it's within rabbinic purview to upend that when there's life at stake or birth at stake and the covenant at stake. So that's that piece. All right, let's push forward. 100A1. I'm on 100A1. We're going to start on the right-hand column of page 100A1. And we're going to get into a dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi, famous pair that dispute things, and in Masechet Eruvin, Rabbi Yossi is known to really be the one with whom halakha, with whom Jewish law goes when they have a debate, even though it's Rabbi Yehuda. It's a big deal. He's a great one of his generation, Rabbi Yossi. So here we're going to hear a braita that's presented to us, and hear about a machloket, hear about a disagreement. So, Ditanya, introducing a Braita, remembering that Braitot have some similar power as Mishnaic reality. So, the right-hand side, the Gemara cites a Braita which records the dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi. So, Ditanya, for its thought in a Braita, 100A1. 100A with a 1 to the... Got it? All right, terrific.
rabbi.
Yeah, exactly. Good. Mafsikin l'shabbatot. We're talking about interrupting meals at the onset of the holiday that is upon us. So let's say we're eating a meal, and it's Friday, and Shabbat comes. Question is, what do we do if we have to do anything? So it's taught in the Braita, Mafsikin l'Shabbatot. We interrupt a meal we're eating at the onset of the Sabbath, particularly at nightfall. Meaning, talk a little bit about the rabbinic day, when the stars come out. The real nightfall. If you know the night is here, you stop Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. That's what Rabbi Yehuda says. Rabbi Yossi Omer. Rabbi Yossi says, Ein Mafsikin. You don't stop. We don't interrupt the meal at nightfall. Now, what is this notion of interrupting and how does it work? So just for right now, let's say we're eating a meal on a Friday afternoon.
But you're not supposed to have a meal between the mincha until 9.5 hours.
Ah, so we know we have from this Mishnah already a tradition that, at least for Erev Pesach, we're not supposed to eat samuch l'mincha. But what else did we hear in a Braita? We also heard that on Shabbatot, what? That we're not supposed to eat from mincha on.
Correct. The 7.5 hours or something.
So, obviously, for sake of argument, they're trying to work out who really has what to say about an instance where we would find someone eating. So again, living law, you know, don't encroach on your right turn in New York City over the crosswalk on a red light. Little by little, the truck is pulling into the crosswalk, blocking it. He's going to be the first one and beat the rest of the pedestrians waiting to cross this way. Law is a living law, and reality is a living reality. And so there are some meals being eaten. Oh, and maybe we're going to get a distinction about these meals to take care of the fact that we brought up the notion that we have braitas that already say, samuch l'mincha, close to mincha on Pesach, don't eat. Mi mincha hala, from mincha on a Shabbat afternoon, don't eat. Well, what's the obvious possibility? Just, it'll come. But what if we're talking about a meal that started way before that? And it just kept going.
So you didn't go for mincha?
Ah, maybe you didn't. Maybe you sat there the whole time. Okay. So far we've got this interruption kind of thing. Now what's the interruption reality? The interruption reality comes along with this. That, and we mentioned this the last time vis-a-vis the Greek and Roman ways of eating, and then plus it was the rabbinic way of eating, that the meal, the custom in the Mishnaic period is to eat at small, personal, individual tables. And these tables are brought out at the beginning of a meal with nice what to eat, nice everything you need, kind of there in front of you. And then, in terms of saying the blessings after the meal, called Birkat HaMazon, they were taken away. So literally, your table, your small individual table, you know, like we have these things called card tables. You had those? Stacked them up and you unfolded them and you put individual one down. I don't know if anybody ever used them. What's that?
We used to call them TV.
That's what I was just going to say. When did they get really personal? When you had your TV dinner on your TV table. This is part of the culture that now only works for a certain number of decades, and nobody else can understand the reference. But I'm happy to say that we probably all share that. Maybe.
I'm aware of that.
Your father told you.
We're not far. I know.
I'm kibitzing with you. So, reality is that That's the way it was. That's the way it was. And when we talk about interrupting, so it says, Masichin l'Shabbatot, I'm reading in the Rashbam now. It's the fifth wide line, if you're following with me in the Hebrew. Im itchil sudato beheter, kodem hamincha. If you made a meal in the permissible time of the day, way before mincha, and you had such a nice meal, you're sitting there with all your friends and you're eating your meal and you're just loving hanging with people and you're lounging out, and it's taking you now, it's beyond 3 hours, rabbinic hours. This is a big, long meal. This is a real feast of sorts. Because it happened, we're thinking on a Shabbos, way before mincha. And when's mincha? When's the plag on mincha? At what hour did we say? 9 hours, 30 minutes of the rabbinic day. So you take the rabbinic day. Again, daylight, 12 hours divided up into equal parts. That's your rabbinic day. 9 hours, 30 minutes, plag on mincha. That's the mincha we're talking about. So you have a nice long meal. A few little Rabbi Yehuda, even to Rabbi Yehuda, Rashbam says, Mafsik sudato miyad, you immediately stop your meal, kishe yechshich, when it gets dark, umekadesh hayom, and you say Kiddush. So here it is again. You start the meal before mincha time, it's Erev Shabbos, it's a Friday. Because you've gotten everything done you need to get done. Let's imagine for a minute, you really are done, and you really want to start things early by way of the feast you've prepared and the people around you want to hang out with. And it, by the way, very early Shabbos. So it's like having a wonderfully long lunch right into the Shabbos day. So 9 hours, 30 minutes, and you stay with me at the place at my house for 2.5 hours, and it gets dark. Not unheard of. What are we supposed to do? He says, you immediately stop, Rabbi Yehuda, even Rabbi Yehuda, Rashbam says, and you make Kiddush. For what?
Shabbat.
So you're Mekadesh Hayom, you make the Kiddush of Friday night. V'kadesh Aleim, She Hechshich, because it got dark. Now, what's interesting about it is Rabbi Yossi says you don't have to stop. Ein mafsikin. And here's what I want to do. I want to take you over, because it's going to be interesting sometimes to see in our learning this time around, sometimes what the Tosafot say and do. Not only to tell you, hey, what's going on with the text over here, and explain it in a way that it becomes really clear. Though it may be clear to us already exactly because we're explaining it aloud. They also will comment on the Jewish law for their time. And we also learn something about the material history, if not the social history, of that time that the Tosfot live in the Middle Ages. These are Ashkenazic Jews living in the Ashkenazic world. And it's interesting what they're going to have to say about the 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th century and how Jews are living versus Jews of the ancient rabbinic period. Right? So that's why I want to look at it deeply. The Tosafot are a collection of teachings. And they have their own style. And in general, we say that there are a few different sources for Tosafot. But we know that one of the rabbis highlighted in the Tosafot in this Vilna edition of the Shas is Rabbi Hananel. He's mentioned quite often. And we have a certain other number of famous Tosafists. This was a school of thought, though, and there are other books, as if we have a shelf open there, we could buy other Tosafot on Talmudic tractates and read inside other Tosafot And it's not just that which is living on the pager. But this is the version of Tosafot we have, and the famous version that's in the Vilna Shas, so it becomes that Tosafot to learn as you go through a Masechta. So the one we're going to look at is this first one, this first wide one that starts, and you see the Tosafot are on the left side of the page if you're in the Hebrew. It's Rabbi Yossi Omer Ein Mafsikim. Rabbi Yossi says we don't interrupt our meal to stop when it gets dark and make Kiddush. And also there's a website that has every Tosafot with an English Beur translation and somewhat of an explanation. And I made copies of that for us. So we'll pass this around. Actually, the reality with Rashi script is that no one wrote in Rashi script. What happened was that the printers, Bomberg and then some of the families who start in Italy, they decide that, let me see if I can slide this over to you. Can you reach it?
Yeah, sure.
And you can start that around, and it's coming to you, Arthur. Should be enough there. The printers need two different fonts. The first time we see it used is actually not Rashi at all, if I'm remembering correctly, but it's the Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi. And we have a printing of his commentary on the book of Isaiah. And then we have those who say, no, it may be that the Chumash with Rashi is before that. I'm sorry. It is the Chumash with Rashi. But we also see it in Nevi'im. And anyway, it's used as the font that is offset against the block font of the Torah or of the prophetic literature. So that's the script that we call Rashi script. Why is it called Rashi script? Because it came with the Rashi Chumash that was printed.
We need two more here.
I'm sorry. No, I have it here. I have it here. I'm sorry. Here. Coming around. Okay, good.
So this is traditional that they put the Tosafot in that kind of a font.
Yeah, and Rashi too.
And Rashi as well. Rashban.
Yeah. Here, first use. This is we have to do this sometimes.
Sorry. Just interesting.
Well, now that I set it up, I don't have reception.
Wi-Fi.
Yeah, I have it on Wi-Fi. I know. It's strange. It's telling me that the Wi-Fi is not working exactly. No Wi-Fi connection.
It worked before.
It does?
Yeah. There are two or a Sarua.
He probably has the two. All day long he is here, so.
There's no internet.
Four or a Sarua public.
No Wi-Fi.
What are we looking for?
Wi-Fi not available.
It's
running, but very slow.
Yeah, so semicursive handwriting taken as a model by early Hebrew typographers. Garten is the other Santino family, Bomberg, who I mentioned, Christian printer in Venice, and their editions of commented texts, such as Rashi, and Mikro Gedolot, and to offset against the square typeface. It doesn't say much more. So, okay. Coming back to it, Dibora Matchil. We say that any kind of quote from the text itself is called in Hebrew a Dibor HaMatchil. A Dibor is a statement, and HaMatchil is that starts with. So this statement that not only starts with, but is said when Rabbi Yossi says, Omer, Ein Mafsikin. So you don't stop your meal. You don't stop your meal, and he's going to add, V'gomer kol hasuda, and finish up with your meal. U'mevarech birkat hamazon, and bless the final blessing over the meal, V'achar kach, and after that, mikadesh, say kiddush, kidemochach bebraita delakaman, as it's going to tell us on page 102 that we've yet to read. Mashma, so therefore we learn, using the shoresh, by the way, mashma in rabbinic text uses the word to hear as to learn. It's a shma'ata. We have the notion that you can hear something to learn it, right? Because it's more of an oral culture. So mashma, we learn from this, de'ein sarich la'asot tzuda l'shem shabbat, de'it sarich ma'lo l'hamtin yafsik miyad. So this, from this we learn, it's not necessary to eat a particular meal, because if one would, why should he wait? Why not interrupt immediately? The itema, the ech ya'asu kiddush b'lo suda. And if you'll say, itema, a rhetorical device by the Tosafot, meaning, so if you're going to bring me the problem now, or you're going to ask me the question, how do you make kiddush without a meal? You just finished your meal. You said birkat hamazon. You're not telling me I have to make a meal. That was what he was saying before. And you're going to tell me I got to make kiddush?
But the kiddush is for the Shabbat. It's not for the food.
Ah, so maybe that's going to be the answer. Halo ein kiddush ela b'makom suda. But he further complicates the problem for us. Because not only are you going to tell me, wait a minute, I don't have to make a meal, you can make kiddush. You also taught me the following, that you can only make kiddush in the place you're eating. So if you tell me that I have to make kiddush in the place where I'm having my sudat Shabbat, in the place where I'm having my Shabbat meal, how can you tell me to finish my meal, say birkat hamazon, and then make kiddush? V'yesh lomar, another rhetorical device in the Tosafot. So here's how we answer. That's the ultimate force of this small rhetorical device. Dechashiv kiddush b'makom suda. That in fact, this is thought of as if it's like kiddush in the location of a meal. Kevan shemiyad achara suda ose kiddush. Because it was immediately after a meal that you made this kiddush. Ve'ota suda olalo l'sudat Shabbat. And this meal that you just ate and you said birkat hamazon over, that counts for your Sabbath meal.
Question. Kiddush, you read it as b'makom suda, location, and I'm reading it b'imkom instead of.
No, it's the place of.
It's b'makom or b'imkom?
It's in the place of your meal. In the place, in the location of.
It was going to be instead of.
No. But it's a nice vort. That's what a vort is made of.
I call them like I see them.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a nice vort. Kidemochach b'tosefta. And that, we learned from the Tosefta that this meal could count. Kidiketane b'milte divreyosi. Umazkir shel shabbat b'birkat hamazon. And you know how we learned it in the Tosefta? Because he said, when I interrupted my meal over there, or stopped it when it got dark, even though I had started by mincha, what did I do in my birkat hamazon? I inserted the Sabbath paragraph. I was supposed to insert the Sabbath paragraph. It got dark, so I insert the Sabbath paragraph, which is what? Retze v'hachalitzeinu. It's the unique paragraph, it's the unique liturgy that occurs in Birkat HaMazon, in the blessings after the meal, when you say the Birkat HaMazon on the Sabbath.
And the extra Harachama on at the end.
And the extra Harachama, but here... Well, that's an interesting question. Let me take it back. That's an interesting question. Umazkir shel Shabbat b'Birkat HaMazon. What exactly did he mean here? Did he mean the Harachaman? Or did he mean the Ritzeva HaChalitzeinu? There are two places where I mention Shabbat. He very well could have meant Harachaman. And I was just going with the Ritzeh out of pure habit. Right? So that's an interesting question. And I have in this Gemara, over here, what's called Biurei HaTosafot, which is not only an explanation of the Tosafot, but a little bit more about what the Tosafot are trying to really say or what they mean. And I'm going to look quickly and see if he says what that is, halachically. Different people have commented on that. Ein Mafsikin. Yitzarich, Malhazin, Yossi. It doesn't give me a detail here as to whether or not we're talking about Ritzei or about the Harachaman.
Could be both.
We can look further in other places, but right now I can't say that I have the answer in these Gemaras. Okay, so anyway, what he does say is that you get to mention Shabbos if you were eating a meal, it got dark, and by saying Birkat HaMazon, you then say Kiddush, and you're really feeling the Shabbos, the presence of Shabbos. What's interesting about that? Obviously, first of all, did I need to say Kiddush before I say Birkat HaMazon? If that was the case, I didn't need to make Kiddush before I say a blessing over my meal and mention Shabbat. Even though typically, just in the way we think, the first thing we do is what? Kiddush. And then the next thing we do is eat a Shabbos meal and say Birkat HaMazon with Shabbat insertions to celebrate the Sabbath. So interesting, we're turning things on their head a little bit if this is the system we're using. And that as, again, more machshava kind of reality. Think about the willingness of the authorities here to find a way, not just around things, but to find a way to allow the order, and we're talking about the Pesach Seder, they allow the order, in many ways, to get mixed up a little bit. And what does it really suggest regarding the way we expect our world to function, our lives to function? Perhaps this is a level that the rabbis, again, didn't necessarily want to spell out in a rational kind of way. But if I ask, post my read of these gemarot, of these limudim, of these lessons in halacha, in Jewish law, and I ask, what is it really saying that I can start a meal at mincha the day before Shabbos, say a blessing over the Sabbath when the three stars come out, and then stand up and say Kiddush on the Sabbath day? And typically, that's not the way I usually do things, right? I go to shul, I go home, I sing Shalom Aleichem, I make Kiddush, I wash, I make a motzi over my challahs, I then eat my Shabbat meal. and then I say Birkat HaMazon with Shabbat insertions. Like, that's the typical mode here. What's it really saying? That I am given this kind of...
If things get messed up, you still can do it the right way.
Yeah, that's a wonderful way to think about what they're saying. Maybe you did mess up. Maybe you had ravenous guests who came in on Friday. And there's no way that they could wait. They just came out of the desert. 3 days. They carried spices for you. And there's just no way that you could stop from serving that incredibly, just wonderful smelling meal that was on the fire. And it was ready enough, you know. You were going to keep it warm for Friday night. And you had to start. So what do you do? Maybe that's the narrative that's behind this, and that now and then you're going to find yourself in that scenario. Maybe it's a now and then.
Things happen.
This is for Shabbat, so what is there's no comparison to Pesach, because Pesach you have a whole Seder. You have...
At least the matzah.
You have to have the matzah, but that's not right away. The matzah doesn't come till middle.
No, but you do kiddush before you start.
You start with kiddush.
If it's on the Friday
but
night.
If you were going to have a meal, do you have matzah before you start the Seder? Or?
So the answer is no, you don't have matzah. So in that sense, the question is, and will come in the Gemara, back into the Gemara, are we talking about eating a meal? Are we really talking about eating a meal? Are we talking about eating a snack? What are we talking about eating?
Right.
Here we are so far on Shabbos, but you're anticipating something. What do we do with the fact that we're in Masechet Pesachim, we're talking about Shabbos and Pesach, and now, anybody who read ahead knows it's coming, but if you didn't, great, because it's a perfect question, Ari. And they're going to get to it. Look at how they get to it. With the same notions that we've been discussing thus far, by the way. Umihu, and nevertheless, again, rhetorical device within a Tosafot text, nevertheless, kashe la Rabbi Yossi, there is a difficulty. Rabbi Yossi brings up, eich ya'asu arba kosot, how will you ultimately wind up doing the four cups of Pesach, because everybody knows that you have as the first step of your Pesach Seder Kiddush. So wait a minute. I'm supposed to eat, say Birkat HaMazon. I know you were talking to me about Shabbos, but you're going to make me, you know, do the parallel structure for Pesach? Is that at all possible? The outright simple answer sounds like it should be just simply not on Pesach. We're talking about Shabbos. Right? Except, here's the amazing part. The Tosafot are actually going to upend the Seder of the Seder. Listen to how it works. Here's the problem, Rabbi Yossi says. Kevan shelo yikadshu, because you can't possibly sanctify the day. Ela achar birkat HaMazon. In other words, you can't possibly say Birkat HaMazon, say what you need to for Pesach, make the bracha over Birkat HaMazon or stop Birkat HaMazon, and then say Kiddush, and have that meal that you just finished count for Pesach. That wasn't the Pesach meal. What am I supposed to do? V'yesh lomar. So here's what we'll say. The Yasu Arba Koso Shelo Kaseder Harigilin La Asot Kos Birkat HaMazon Techila the Acharav Kos Shel Kiddush. So here's the answer he gives. Don't do the regular order of the four cups on Pesach. So don't do it. What are you going to say what's the order? You make the first cup on Birkat HaMazon. Like you're thinking that you're going to have to make the last in the last part of the Seder. And then, since you've done your Birkat HaMazon cup at the beginning, including Pesach, now do a Kos Shel Kiddush, then do a cup for Kiddush, V'yirakot Acharav, and then have your greens, and then say your Kos Shlishi, L'manishtana v'acharav maror. Go do manishtana, go do maror. V'al kos revi'i halel. And the fourth cup you'll just say over the halel. So you'll have done already your Birkat HaMazon. And you'll be done with it. And that actually was your first cup in this setup. What's that saying about the meal, if I take him word for word, or take his words for granted? What did he not mention? Which mitzvah?
Matzah.
But we know, wait a minute, but we know that in fact the mitzvah of matzah is a requirement on the first night of Pesach. So what's the possible solution for how we say Birkat HaMazon on the proper lechem, on the proper matzah that we need to have eaten in order to say the Birkat HaMazon of Pesach? First of all, we know that the halacha is that on the night of Pesach, because we heard that mentioned before, right? The leil, balayla. On the night of Pesach, we need to eat matzah. So what must have happened in terms of this meal?
No, that meal was without, but maybe later you can have a matzah, and that's it.
Well, that meal it seems like that meal started like the one in the beginning of the commentary, which is, it started early. Maybe not at Mincha, maybe the Pesach one started before even it got Samuch LeMincha, before it got close to Mincha. Maybe it was a big, long, I got to start this really early. And I'm not talking about when you start it really early for your children, but I might be. Things happen. Life comes. Maybe that's one reason. But what do I need to do when the stars come out?
You need to say the Kiddush.
I need to say Kiddush, but what mitzvah do I need to do in order to say the Birkat HaMazon over the proper food on Pesach? I need to eat the matzah. So one possibility in my mind that's not written explicitly in this Tosafot is that what it's saying is that you started early and all the family was together and so-and-so came and the Pesach ritual began, and somehow you were sitting at these little tables, right? And it's getting dark. And somebody, at the moment the stars come out, rushes in with the matzah. They say the mitzvah blessing over achilat matzah. They then stop, mafsikin, take the tables, and say Birkat HaMazon over the cup of wine, because that's the tradition we have, to say Birkat HaMazon, the blessing over the food, over a cup of wine. Have you ever seen that tradition, by the way? Someone raises a cup of wine to start Birkat HaMazon, mm-hmm. Holds it in their hand, and then after the Birkat HaMazon is going to say Borei Pri HaGafen. That's going to be mentioned later as a typical tradition within the context of Jewish life, in this Masechet, in this tractate. But so far, we're familiar with the saying of Kiddush at the end of a meal. Or we're thinking about it as the saying of Birkat HaMazon with the proper insertion, and then Kiddush. And, of course, the end of this Tosafot suggests that this Kiddush is going to be the what? The Kiddush of Pesach. So obviously, if I need to make the Birkat HaMazon over the proper foods for the night, the mitzvah for the night, I've got to figure out where that matzah fit in. And my only solution, according to just what I've read, and by the way, I haven't read that in here yet, I haven't looked here yet, what the solution is or what the Rishonim said, because I wanted us to creatively kind of think about this, end of this Tosafot. It sounds to me like the only way that I really have to make this make any sense, parallel to my Shabbat example, is if Birkat HaMazon is going to count for my Pesach meal, and for my Pesach meal, I need my matzah. And even though I wasn't supposed to eat my matzah on Erev Pesach, and I didn't because I started my meal and I sat there for hours with my gang, as soon as it got dark, maybe I ate it, took care of it, said Birkat HaMazon, that counted for my Birkat HaMazon of Pesach, and now I had my Kiddush, and I count that as
the first cup,
or in this case, you see it says Kos Birkat HaMazon Techila. So that's not exactly Kiddush. That is the cup that I say Borei Pri HaGafen on of Birkat HaMazon, which is the twist in here. And that's the first cup. The second cup here is Koshel Kiddush. The third cup here is after Yirakot, after the greens, and then Manishtana, Maror, and then on the fourth cup, I say Hallel. Do I have any other way of explaining where matzah fits in?
Wouldn't it be simple to just stick with the order, don't eat?
Yeah, it would be. Why? It would be simpler.
But why did I put maror if the matzah just precedes that? And nagara, it comes right before the maror part.
Ah, it does come right before, right?
So why would they just put maror and not just put matzah right there?
So Ari, so then the question is, in putting maror in, is that assuming that that's Rabban Gamliel's three major simanim, Pesach, Matzah, Maror, and I'm completely wrong? That it's not about matzah the time it gets dark at all, but I'm still counting the first cup of wine during the nighttime hour, when the three stars came out, as my first cup, even though I had to make this other meal that didn't include matzah? But when it comes to the Birkat HaMazon, again, that I need to say because I've benched over matzah when I eat my maror, after I eat the mitzvah of maror, right? Because remember, we're going to get the mitzvah of maror, right? And then how do I do the mitzvah of maror? I take my chunk of maror, or my really bitter lettuce leaves, or my really bitter horseradish root, and I dip it in haroset. I don't eat that on matzah.
That's cheating. Making it sweet?
No, that's the dip.
I'm kidding.
That's the second tevila.
I'm kidding. It's got to be bitter. Make it bitter. Don't cheat with the harosha.
After that in my Seder, yes, I would normally eat matzah. I would bench motzi lechem in haaretz and al mitzvat matzah. And then I'd eat matzah. So am I still doing that, saying Birkat HaMazon and just excluding a cup of wine at Birkat HaMazon? Or am I even still including a cup with Birkat HaMazon and not counting that as one of my four?
But if you've turned the order upside down, or you've changed it, if the last is first and the first is last, why can't you eat matzah whenever you want to eat matzah?
Yeah.
Or it's not even the last.
It's
the third, really. Because
okay.
I still have that cup over Hallel.
So you really, like, stirred it up.
I've stirred it up a little bit.
A lot.
I'm willing to.
Yeah, so you can eat matzah, so as long as you eat matzah.
Who says that you cannot eat matzah during the year? So maybe they eat matzah with the meal.
Oh, for sure. There's a mitzvah to not eat, or it's a commandment. You don't eat matzah on the 14th, for sure.
Right.
whether you don't eat it from Rosh Chodesh Nisan or you don't eat it all year is a matter of debate in the halachic authorities. So that is part of the tradition going on. For sure on the 14th, you're not allowed.
I don't eat it all year.
And some eat only the matzah that says not for Passover use, because it's made in a factory that's not really set to really create the matzahs you need for the Passover Seder. Okay, so I just want to see if we get any further insight over here. Okay. All right, so here is a note on the word maror. Let's see what it says. In another Tosafot, heksha dekomo shehamatza ochel besuda. Vayetze. So it seems like there's a problem here because of the place of matzah eating. So okay, so we're validated that that's really a difficulty here. Amai lo yochal gama yirakot v'hamaror v'suda. Oh, so with my solution that maybe he ate the matzah by that other suda, the one that started before, but when it got dark, maybe they ate the matzah. The question is, and I'm pushing it all the way there, even though this question is, why didn't it say with that meal over which you're going to say Birkat HaMazon, not only to eat matzah, but you should also eat the yirakot, have your greens, have the karpas, and also include the maror back then? So if you start a meal on the 14th of Nisan and it's done, I'm guessing, way before Mincha, because that's the only, at this point, kind of license I've got based on the fact that we brought up what we knew from the Brightas, which was right before Pesach, Samuch LeMincha, close to Mincha, by 9 hours of the day, I can't even start. But if you started the meal and you had all your guests and you had all the children and everybody was hungry and you had all this wonderful food and you just had to start, and you didn't start the Haggadah, per se, you didn't have that text even. There's a radical statement that we just have to remember. We'll come back to that several times. You didn't have a Haggadah. You didn't sit down and say, everybody open the book to page Aleph. Maybe that's a major thing to remember here, that at this point you don't have that set liturgical device of a Haggadah at your place. Very important to remember. But you have mimesis going on with Pesach tradition. You have a passing along of tradition. You have an oral tradition, a Mishnah, a Gemara, that says this is what we do. We, of course, remember Rabban Gamliel's statement that Pesach Matzah Maror is indeed central to the endeavor. But for whatever reason, life happens. I started the meal. I'm eating. I am at my Pesach moment where the three stars come. I know it's important to not have said Kiddush until the three stars come, and the Tosafot tell me, at least in medieval Ashkenaz, maybe it's the same by way of Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda arguing in the Talmudic age. What do you do? Do you stop your meal right now, and do you say Birkat HaMazon as if it was still the day before, and then you start by saying Kiddush, or do you take a cup of wine, and do you say Birkat HaMazon over that cup of wine, which is our tradition, and include kind of this notion that Birkat HaMazon, like we said with Shabbos before, is really connected to a meal of Shabbat. The same way I did that for Shabbat, do I say that I now count this meal that I just ate, even though there's a tradition not to start it so early on the 14th, but I started so much earlier for whatever, the reasons, do I say now, that was my meal, and in order to make it my meal, did I need to eat my matzah there? And is that why I didn't mention it in the Tosafot? But this other commentary, Tosafot, bring up the question on the Tosafot and say, but wait a minute, if that is my Pesach meal because you brought out matzah, you ate it, you said Birkat Hamazon over a cup, and you're even counting that as your first cup of wine for the four cups in the Seder, you better put in the Yirakot, the Karpas, and the Maror. Because those are essential mitzvot to do at this, what we call the Pesach banquet that we're creating in rabbinic culture right now. The Seder. And so that's the difficulty I have. I'm just seeing if there's here. So that's the difficulty I have. And they're going to have to do a workout, the Tosafot, if they're really going to allow this kind of uprooting the regular Seder of the Seder to happen, especially in their time, in medieval Ashkenaz. And they're going to have to explain it really well and get really clear on whether or not they really mean that people can start at all, or get more strict about not letting people start, or allowing us to uproot a little bit of the order of things, because by that time in medieval Ashkenaz, we do have a Haggadah.
Right. Can it be that this story is the concept that was established before the Haggadah as a story of the Seder, to be the main issue, was part of the meal? Could it be that the mitzvah of eating matzah and telling the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim before the Haggadah was established, they had the meal, they finished the meal, they brought the matzah, they said Kiddush, and they said on the four cups, and there was no Haggadah at all at that time. It's only later that the order was changed, and the meal was part of the story.
What you have is the discussion of this kind of funky order where people are eating
before
in the Tosafot. You also have in the Braita meals that are being eaten before and or snacks. We didn't get to the distinctions that are made in the language yet within the Talmud. So it is true that the landscape of when we eat, what we eat, is very loose. And it's also true that if the Tosafot are talking about it, that the when we eat, what we eat question is still alive. And how I actually make my Seder on any given day, any given Pesach, any given year, really comes down to how I take seriously all the obligations that I am required. Whether or not I have a Haggadah for everybody in my household and I run my Seder exactly as I need to, according to this booklet, this Haggadah, I can play still with the notion of where the four cups come in, according to this Tosafot a little bit. Because instead of later on, and let's say what I did, is I didn't eat my matzah at that meal that I started early. Let's say for a minute that the Birkat Hamazon included a harachaman for Yontif, because Yontif started, and I only said Borei Pri HaGafen on the cup of wine that I lifted. I didn't say Kiddush yet, the full Kiddush. Asher b'harbanu mikolam v'romam ta'anu mikolashon. Right? I didn't say the full kiddush of the evening for Passover. But I said Brorei Pri HaGafen on the cup of Birkat HaMazon because I ate enough mazon, whatever I ate, to say Birkat HaMazon. My problem is I don't know what he ate to say Birkat HaMazon over. So this is the big problem in my head, vis-a-vis why I have to say that I think that they did eat matzah at that point, when the stars came out. But let's say, whatever, I say Birkat HaMazon, and how they said Birkat HaMazon, again, is a question. I still, at that point, can count that cup of wine I say Borei Pri HaGafen over as my first, and I've uprooted the way that it normally appears in my Haggadah, if I'm dealing with a very set Haggadah, because that usually is my third cup. The cup after the meal and after the, you know, over which I bench. I lift up my cup and I say Borei Pri HaGafen over my Birkat HaMazon, and then my fourth is Hallel. Here, though, I have my Birkat HaMazon number one, my Kiddush number two,
the
Maror number three, and over Hallel number four. So I do find, again, some of this looseness that's inherent in the system when it comes to people and their choices and their creating meals at these moments of holiday time.
How did the tradition for four cups come about?
So that we saw was in the Rashbam linked to the four different languages of redemption.
But that was a recent time?
No, right in.
At that time?
No, that was at that time.
Or is that gone back to
the book? Yeah, because the first Mishnah that we studied said there were four cups, right? And the inherited tradition about why those four cups was because there were four different languages of
Exodus.
Redemption. And the four different languages, you know, Hotseitem, Lakachtem, Hevetem, and Gaaltem, that I have four different ways that God explains that I've redeemed you from Egypt, and therefore I have the four cups. Everybody was included in that redemption, and therefore even the poorest among you, we said last week, would have to have the cups of wine. Redemption was for everybody. Interesting how they're willing to uproot it and have the discussion even there and leave it somewhat open to our mindsets as to how this is actually going to work out entirely. I have to tell you that for the second night Seder, not so much the first, there's always debate in a very traditional place in New Jersey, Teaneck, New Jersey. There's always some debate among even those who are really traditional and trying to hold to every mitzvah the mitzvah. They're trying to do all the commandments in the right way. They're trying to do the Haggadah, the Seder in the right way. I have been privy to conversations among certain members of communities that you would think wouldn't discuss any kind of looseness at all. How are we going to do this with the children? On the second night. They stayed up all night the first night. They were, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. We want them to have a Seder experience. Oh, so they have one framework in which they can do it all and not have to think that they're actually performing the mitzvahs at the wrong time. That framework is called L'shem Chinuch, in the name of educating a child. So in the name of educating a child, people will go through some of the ritual mitzvot in order to say the authentic prayer, blessing, or do the practice that otherwise would be ordained, quote-unquote, after the three stars come out, when it gets dark. Interesting. That kind of theoretical framework, again, coming in to give you an overlay of how you approach these. Let's push forward in the Gemara now that we've had that adventure into the land of Tosfot. So, again, back to 100a1. So, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi disagree, and now we're going to get a Maase. We're going to get Mashe Haya. This incident occurred. Umase b'Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. And what you see is that Rabbi Yehuda's name is in brackets there. Yeah? So I'm on the bottom of 100A1, right-hand side. The last line. So there's an incident with Shimon ben Gamliel. V'Rabbi Yehuda is in brackets. V'Rabbi Yossi. So, just to note, why is Rabbi Yehuda in brackets? Because some texts have Rabbi Yehuda in the picture, and some texts, some girsaot, some versions leave him out. Or one seems like it was saying he might be on his way. Okay, so there are different versions of this story. So we have to think about the different versions and why there might be different versions. So Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is sitting with Rabbi Yossi. Either Rabbi Yehuda was there, either Rabbi Yehuda is on his way, or Rabbi Yehuda is not there at all.
He was there in spirit.
Remind yourself, Rabbi Yehuda says what? When it gets dark and you started the meal? Rabbi Yehuda says?
You stop.
Mafsik. Rabbi Yossi says?
No.
You don't stop. Okay? Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, Rabbi Yossi is sitting. Shehayu mesubim ba'ako. And they were reclining and dining in Akko on the coast. Beautiful waves. Ve kadash alehem hayom. Nice way to say it got dark, right? And it was time for Kiddush. It was time for Kiddush. Amar lo Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Rabbi Yossi. So Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel turns and says, Rabbi Yossi, Bibiribi, great, affectionate term of authority. The Rebbe of the generation, my Rebbe. Ritzonach nafsich v'nechush v'divrei Rabbi Yehuda chavereinu. Would you like for us to interrupt the meal and recite Birkat Hamazon and respect or go according to the view of Rabbi Yehuda, our colleague? Amarlo, Rabbi Yossi says, B'chol yom v'yom, ata mechabev divarai lifnei Rabbi Yehuda. Every day, you respect my words in the presence of Rabbi Yehuda. In other words, you hold halacha by me. You paskin by me. You decide like me. V'achshav ata mechabev divrei Rabbi Yehuda b'fanai. And now you're wishing to respect Rabbi Yehuda's halachic position, legal position on this matter. Hagam lichbosh et hamalkah imi b'bayit. Quoting Esther, he says, do you mean to capture the queen while I am in the house? In other words, is Rabbi Yehuda now like your queen Esther? And I am the evil Haman? Amarlo, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says to him, Im kein. Now he has to figure out how to translate this. If that's how you're feeling about this, or if that's what you're thinking, or if that's so, or if this is what you want, lo nafsik, we won't interrupt the meal. Shema yiru hatalmidim v'yikba'u halakha ledorot. Because perhaps you're right, the students will see in accordance with Rabbi Yehuda, and they'll rule and erroneously establish the halacha like Rabbi Yehuda. Because you're right, I agree with you, in other words, that the halacha is what? Ein mafsikim. Yossi, you're right. Amru, they said, Lo zazu misham, they didn't move from there, ad shekav'u halakha ka Rabbi Yossi. They didn't move from there until the halakha was completely established like Rabbi Yossi. Okay, so what's the story mean? If Rabbi Yehuda was there, let's first deal with it. If Rabbi Yehuda was there,
probably would stop. If it would be really
let's say he is present. Option A, Rabbi Yehuda is present.
They would ask him too. They didn't ask him. They asked only Rabbi Yossi.
So your chashash, your feeling is that he's not there. I'm asking though. What if he was there? This conversation ensues with Rabbi Yehuda present. But the conversation is between Shimon ben Gamliel and Rabbi Yossi.
It would be insulting.
Well, in a certain way, insulting. Another way might be to interpret it.
Is that you're showing respect for him, that even though everybody knows that the two of them disagree, you're going to do it his
way. That's right, because we have a tradition that Hillel and Shammai were arguing about the law. Right? Famous sugya. And a bat kol comes out of heaven, a divine voice, and says, Eilu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim. This one's halachic opinion and that one's halachic opinion are the words of the living God. Aval. But the halacha goes according to Beit Hillel. Now, by the way, there's a few times that it goes to Beit Shammai. So and you can find those, and it's a fun exploration of Mishnaic and Talmudic literature to see where Shammai comes out. But the reality is that if that's the overwhelming sense of the rabbinic value we're supposed to learn every time possibly it comes that two people sound like they're in the right, but I've got to decide one way, well, this is one of those examples, perhaps, an agudic example, a legend, according to the way Rav Nitzky translated Chaim Nachman Bialik's book, Sefer HaAgadot, the book of legends. Well, this is, in that sense, a legendary tale, a holy tale of bringing to life that which is expressed in a more values orientation. The value being, we have two ways of understanding halachic outlooks, but we know we have to decide one of them needs to be functional law, and thusly, a story like this comes along if Rabbi Yehuda is present. If Rabbi Yehuda is present. Of course, the verse that he includes from Megillat Esther and compares his colleague.
That's a low blow.
Right? You almost wish you could find a version where he didn't say that.
When I first saw on the side, it said over here, Torah or Hashalom, and I was...
Hashalem,
all right, that's right. Hashalem, I was saying, what the heck is that doing in the Gemara, you know, from the Purim Megillah, and then it came in, and I said, wow, that's kind of nasty.
Right, so what Debbie's pointing out is that in this Gemara, there's a little, what's called a kli, there's a tool, that includes the whole verse that is quoted in part in our Talmud text, includes the whole verse in Hebrew on the gutter, in the gutter of the page. And that verse from Esther that's included here, of course, the famous one where Haman is begging Esther and kind of like implying that you're making me beg. And you're making me beg Rabbi Yehuda in a certain way, right? Now, we could take that to mean that Rabbi Yossi is really demanding that Shimon ben Gamliel stay true and loyal
to
Rabbi Yossi. And kind of it's an overstatement. It's hyperbolic. And he uses such a hyperbolic verse to make his point. This happens in the parlance of Jews. You know, someone does you wrong, okay? Does you a little wrong. Speaks against an idea you had. And someone quotes the Gemara. kabduhu v'chashtuhu. Respect him, but always suspect him. That's a low blow. That really, that hurts your heart. That pierces your heart. Forever, you look at that person who really says that in a moment of anger.
Don't point to me.
I'm not pointing. I'm saying the low blow. I'm agreeing with you that these low blows sometimes really can get you. They really can get you, and they stick with you because...
It's worse than anything else.
Right, they stick with you. So yeah, it sounds like that. But it's also to make a really, really kind of serious point, rhetorically. And Rabbi Yossi's interested in being the authority and remaining the authority. And, of course, he doesn't want the students to err.
You don't usually see something, a comment like that. Was that very common in other books?
Well,
I've never really heard that. When somebody speaks in such a tone to another rabbi, who's supposedly very respected.
We had a wonderful couple of classes in the summer. I don't remember if you came. Studying insults in the Gemara. All right, I think that we studied that. Yeah, so there were quite a number of insults thrown at one another, and quite a number of what we call Memra Harifa, a very kind of spicy way of answering a colleague.
Sharp.
And whether it was a disagreement about those scholars who lived in Eretz Yisrael and you were Babylonian, that caused a lot of kind of... They would call each other everything from idiots to babes just born to those who needed to return to the swamps they came from. Really. So this is pretty, let's say, you know, high level kind of daggers, where you're quoting a verse and you're expecting the other to know the context, and you've used Tanakh, you've used the Jewish Bible to get your point across or your point in someone's back. And so it's a possibility. Let's say, though, that Rabbi Yehuda was not there. Why would there be any question from Shimon ben Gamliel? Should we respect your colleague Rabbi Yehuda, who's about to arrive?
Because he's supposed to come for the meal. Maybe they are waiting for him to come for the holiday. So they want to wait for him. If he's on the way.
Mm-hmm. So maybe it is a matter of saying that he's supposed to get here for that moment, and we would like to make note of that moment. And
so let's start with him when he will be here.
But it says that all three were reclining in Akk.
It does say that. And what I was mentioning is that we have different versions where Rabbi Yehuda seems not to be in the picture.
I would think he would not be there.
Yeah. So he's kind of not there. Look at note 16. When Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel originally asked Rabbi Yossi to interrupt the meal in consideration of Rabbi Yehuda, he was not concerned that this would cause the students to establish the halacha in accordance with Rabbi Yehuda. He wasn't thinking about that, for they would have taken it as a courtesy to Rabbi Yehuda rather than as a halachic ruling. Now, however, that Rabbi Yossi objected, had Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel interrupted the meal over the objection of Rabbi Yossi, the students would have taken it as an indication that the halacha indeed accords with Rabbi Yehuda.
But you made it personal.
Right. So you have it as a personal situation. You obviously, according to the way that note is understanding it, and the Tosfot are understanding it, the students are there. It's not just like some theoretical thing. The students are watching the Rebbe's and how they behave. And this, too, is a trope within the Gemara. In Masechet Brachot, there's the very famous and lovely story of the student who follows Hillel into the bathhouse. You know, what are you doing? Gamzu Torah, Lilomod Ota Anitzarich. This is also Torah, and I need to learn it. He goes from the bathhouse and follows him home to his bedroom. Gamzu Torah. This is also Torah, and I need to learn it. You know, so this trope of the students hanging out by their rebbes to actually learn how to live life is an important aspect of what's going on here. And maybe, let me suggest this in terms of we called it a low blow before and we know how biting it could be. Maybe it's humorous. Maybe it's so sarcastic that it's supposed to be sarcastic and humorous. Anybody buy it?
Sarcastic for sure, but the argument is still the same. But the issue is the same.
The issue is the same, but the issue can be the same, and I can lighten the load with quoting it in such a way that it brings out the humorous in it all. What is he, your new queen?
Yeah, I was going to say the queen reference could be tongue-in-cheek and humorous, meant to be humorous.
And calling himself Haman, like, you know, Rabbi Yossi? Yeah. Rabbi Yossi of Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Yossi gets law generally decided in his favor versus the greatest sage of the Mishnah? You know, so I think the way to read this has at its core a kind of humorous response that would have been very humorous in the rabbinic Beit Midrash where the Talmidim are concerned. And I think we can sit a little easier with how he says it, whether he's sitting there or he's not sitting there, Rabbi Yehuda. And so it doesn't make the difference to me because I think there's a great exchange here among really clever sages. And, of course, you know, he gets it that, yeah, if he does it, if it actually comes to maaseh, if it actually comes to the level of letting it go and letting them do it like that, the students just might get the wrong idea. But there was a humorous exchange versus a very critical and insulting exchange, in this case particularly because of the relationship that I can think about between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi.
It's been a big rivalry. And then this phrase, Lechboshet HaMalkai MiBabayit, it's like a literary insult. It reminds me that someone said that the British can insult you and it takes you for two real English style of discourse. Someone can insult you and it takes you 2 days to realize that you've been insulted. when you speak high language, high culture,
it's right.
A literary insult. You have to know what it means. It's also a little risque, it's edgy. It's, you know, you said divrei Elohim chayim. For me, this is divrei, you know, life. It's
yeah.
Reality. It's like taking it to the edge.
Yeah. Anyway, here's the introduction for the next time we meet. We'll just say it plainly after all that. Next little paragraph, 182. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda then says in the name of Shmuel, here, this is what we really learned. Ain halacha loka Rabbi Yehuda v'loka Rabbi Yossi? The halacha is neither by Rabbi Yehuda nor by Rabbi Yossi. Ela pores mapav mikadesh. Rather, when night falls during the meal, one doesn't take away the table and mafsik. You just throw a cloth over the food on the table and you recite Kiddush and you continue eating. There we go. Alternative to be continued the next time. And everybody enjoy whatever next meal that they're going to have.
Do you want to see dual class tomorrow?